Angie and I are honored to bring you the following podcast. We didn't know at the time we recorded it that it would be the last time we would share stories, laughs, and wisdom with Kaylee Walstead. Unfortunately, Kaylee passed away unexpectedly but peacefully in her sleep. We would like to express our respect to Kaylee for her years spent contributing to the e-discovery industry and for being our colleague and our friend. Her passing is a sudden and heartbreaking loss, not only to the e-discovery community she cared for so deeply, but also her friends and her family, who were her true joy. Kaylee was a champion for e-discovery, always finding ways to share knowledge, uplift others, and move us forward together. Her impact will live on in the standards she promoted, the colleagues she mentored, and the relationships she built. But beyond her professional accomplishments, it was Kaylee's spirit that made her truly unforgettable. She was a ray of sunshine in every room, the one who cheered us on when challenges felt heavy, who always found the time to ask how we were doing and truly listen. She loved people with all of her heart, and she had a way of putting others before herself in a manner that felt genuine and rare. Kaylee leaves behind a legacy of kindness, generosity, and encouragement. If we can carry even a fraction of her spirit forward, if we could pause to lift one another up the way that she did, we would honor her memory in the way she would have wanted. While we feel the weight of this loss, we are grateful for the time we had with Kaylee. She made our industry better, and more importantly, she made us better.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of eDiscovery Chicks, the podcast about all things eDiscovery and legal tech, hosted by two gals who have the ultimate score of podcast guests today. Anyways, we're your hosts. That's Bree.
And that's Angie. And I can't even believe, pinch me, is it real? We have the original, I mean, I don't know if we should say like the original goated podcast, or if we should say the queens of eDiscovery. Like, I don't know.
I think all fit.
Yeah. But if it wasn't for the two guests that we have today, so many of us would not have been as successful as we have been in our industry. And they were the trailblazers that inspired women like Angie and I to get on a podcast and talk about eDiscovery. So, Angie, I don't want to keep talking and leave everybody so suspenseful.
Oh,
who's okay. Here?
We have with us the one, the only, Mary Mack and Kaylee Walstead. We are beyond thrilled to have you both here today. But without further ado, let me introduce you both to our audience. Mary Mack is one of the most respected voices in the e-discovery and legal technology world. She is the CEO and chief legal technologist at EDRM, the e-discovery reference model, which has long been the framework for guiding how legal professionals think about the e-discovery lifecycle. And she is an absolute pioneer in this field, a fierce advocate for access to justice, and a champion of innovation in legal tech. Whether she's speaking on stage, mentoring up-and-coming professionals, or co-hosting her long-running podcast, Mary brings a deep sense of clarity, curiosity, and purpose to everything she does. And Kaylee now. We have Kaylee today, too. She is the Chief Strategy Officer at EDRM and one of the most beloved connectors in the eDiscovery community. Kaylee is known for her fabulous eyewear, her unmatched energy, her global reach, and her unwavering commitment to building bridges between legal, technology, and business professionals. She has helped grow EDRM into a truly international force and has been instrumental in its evolution, especially in driving the collaborative effort behind EDRM 2.0. She is also the co-host of the EDRM podcast and a constant source of inspiration, insight, and of course, plenty of joy. Mary and Kaylee, welcome to the pod.
Oh my goodness.
Do you even know what to say, Mary? We're beyond.
No. Oh my gosh. Thank you. That was such a lovely, warm introduction.
It's always my goal to just heartily embarrass our guests by singing their praises up top.
Well, we speak nothing but the truth. And we know today it's a little bit like a role reversal because you guys are used to being the podcast host. And today you are the guest. So thank you for allowing us the honor to be your host. And I know from listening to the Illumination Zone your podcast, that you like to do something with your guest called a fun fact. So when people come to visit you, you ask them to share something fun about themselves. So since we're turning the tables, I'm going to start with you guys. And Mary, I'm gonna ask you, what's a fun fact?
Oh, okay. I'll give you a fun fact. And it's it is still a little early here in our Portland, Oregon. So my fun fact for today will be, in my youth, I played donkey softball.
What never is heard of donkey softball?
So donkey softball is it's a fundraiser. There's also such a thing as donkey basketball, but I've only watched that game. But donkey softball, you get up there, you hit the ball, and you jump on a donkey, and then the donkey takes you to first.
Real donkey?
A real donkey, if it wants to.
And then
when the next person hits, you get on your donkey and you're running to, you're trotting to second, if it wants to. And so anyway, I guess my claim to fame is 2 sprained wrists.
Oh my gosh.
From donkey softball, but I'd do it again in an instant. It's so much fun.
Maybe is very unique.
That's what we should do at the EDRM 2.0 launch party. Donkey sports.
There we go.
Oh my gosh. Well, I think I probably have more than 2 sprained wrists if I do that. What about you, Kaylee?
Now, how do I follow up donkey softball? I cleaned up with that one. That's a home run right there.
I see what you did there.
That's right. All right. My fun fact that very few people know about me is that I am a Pokemon card collector and nerd. And so,
Oh yeah.
My daughter, Ashley, who is an adult, not a child, but a married adult, got me started in January. And she's like, Mom, you and I are going to go to collectible stores like we used to when she was little. And I would buy Pokemon cards for my kids and they did tournaments. And anyway, there's been a resurgence with Pokemon, which I did not know. And so we, in January, went to our first collectible store. And the card set that my daughter wanted to do was called 151, which was all the originals. It was really hard of her because I knew all of them. And I'd be like, oh, Squirtle. Oh, look at you. And so every Saturday, minus just a few, since I would say the beginning of January, we go to usually our favorite collectible store. But she takes me on field trips to others as well. Literally, we call them field trips.
Oh, my God.
Then we come back to my house. And we have a huge ripping party and we collect all the major hits, which is super fun. We scream when we get one. We're like yelling and shaky and it's so much fun. And then there's a lot of bulk cards that aren't the major hits. And so the first time I realized it was kind of a big deal, in 2 weeks, I pulled what they call a chase card.
What's a chase card?
Like, in this particular set, everyone's chasing that card. It's the top card. Everyone wants it. So a pack of cards, put it in perspective, I think this one was $9. Anyway, 2 weeks in a row, I pulled that top chase card. So we had a duplicate. And within an hour, Ashley had sold it on eBay for almost $500.
Wow.
What?
Oh, yeah.
That's incredible.
So when we get those duplicates now, they get reinvested back into buying more cards. And eventually one day we hope to have, my daughter's name is Ashley, L-E-E, Kaylee, L-E-E. We want to have Lee's Collectibles. I've already had Gen AI create a logo. And yeah, so we're just having blast. Every
I
Saturday,
love that.
We're ripping
I
cards.
I love that. And I love that you're doing it together. That's awesome.
You know
that's
what? It's really nice to find ways to connect with your adult children. And it's just, I can't even tell you how much fun I've been having.
That's great. Well, and it's hard for children sometimes to connect with their adult parents. So it's good for both of you. That's awesome. Well, thank you both for sharing your fun fact. I mean, how did it feel being on the other side of that question? It's all right.
You're making it easy so far.
I did have just a brief deer in the headlights moment.
A brief panic. Well, you both sailed through. Let's transition into talking about the EDRM, which I know will not put either of you in a deer in the headlights position because this is your bailiwick through and through. Let's start by talking about EDRM 1.0. It's about 25 years old now. And so for listeners who might be newer to the field, can you explain just super briefly, like, what is the EDRM and why was it even created?
The EDRM, what we're talking about now is the drawing and the model. So it's electronic discovery reference model. When we first started in eDiscovery, we had a challenge communicating inside counsel to outside counsel, legal to technology, lit support to paralegals, all about this new thing called eDiscovery. And so the model was the originating need for it was as a communication device to level set where you are in the process and have a consistent vocabulary and functional scheme to talk about. And it was created by Tom Geldman and George Socha. And they looked at the internet stack because it's a nice visual and it helped orient people who were advancing the internet. They thought that there could be something like that for eDiscovery. And so a group of people got together and put that first diagram out. And it's changed over the years in very, very small increments. And Kaylee, wouldn't you say our biggest epiphany when we were traveling globally was that every single slide deck started with the EDRM model. And as they were talking about, you know, what problem they were solving, what product or service they were promoting, and we were just like, wow, this thing is everywhere.
Well, you called it graffiti.
Yes.
I mean, she was like, man, but I remember when it really struck us. We had gone to Japan, to Tokyo, for kind of a world conference. And there were literally people from all over the globe. So somebody from Brazil, somebody from Japan, somebody from Germany, somebody from South Africa, they all started with the EDRM diagram. And then that's when Mary was like, it's like graffiti, man. It's everywhere.
See, I thought you were denigrating the artwork, but no, you were talking about its prevalence.
Yes. But that was before we had even acquired the EDRM. Like, it was so iconic. And to realize that it was really that global was, you know, really struck us at the time. And I want to give Tom Geldman and George Socha, the co-founders of the EDRM, big props because they had a lot of meetings and consistently heard the same issue, which is we need some way to be able to communicate. And they took the initiative, got some of the best people together, and it really has not changed a lot in 25 years. Cosmetically, yeah, we changed some colors. An IGRM model, a circle to represent that was added to the front end. But really, there hasn't been substantive changes.
And if any of our listeners are sitting out there thinking, what is the EDRM and what's this MFOGA wheel and what does all this mean? You can go, of course, to the EDRM website. And there's tons of resources there. Also, Angie and I spent our whole first year podcasting going over the EDRM at each step of the way. So if there's something you're curious about, another way to find out. But what made you guys decide initially to invest in the EDRM anyway? Like, what made you look at the graffiti and say, I want a piece of that?
That's some Banksy status stuff.
Well, we didn't even know that was possible. Kaylee and I were involved in a refresh of another organization. And it was time for us to step away. So we did. And we didn't know what we were going to be doing after that. So we put our International Women of Mystery tagline out on LinkedIn, and law.com was, or Legal Tech News, I think it was at the time, Reese Dipshon and some of the other folks were kind enough to do a little article. 2 weeks later, we get a phone call, and Duke University, both the Bolch Judicial Institute, which had purchased the EDRM from Tom and George, were ready to say, the volunteer thing is, you know, a little different than we thought. And so they asked if we were interested in acquiring it. And Kaylee and I were like, what? You can do that? And so 6 weeks later, we came to a lovely agreement. And now we are entering our sixth year of stewarding this wonderful community. It's groundbreaking and foundational body of work. And we couldn't be more proud of our project leaders, our project participants, all the people who come together to create resources that help each other. I call us an oasis of collaboration in an adversarial system. You know, the Sedona Conference has put out the cooperation proclamation. The judges have all signed it. I think our project teams embody that spirit of cooperation and collaboration across the V. Kaylee, what am I leaving out there?
Nothing, except I like to call the acquisition of the EDRM our Cinderella story. We literally, from start to finish, it was 2 weeks. And we were like,
oh my God,
what just happened? And we had just stepped away from the association that we had been working with for quite a while. So, you know, you never know what's out there, what's waiting. And just, yeah, Cinderella story.
That's awesome. And I have to say, the community that you describe, both of you, I've also experienced to be true. And a lot of that starts with you guys. Yeah. You lead by example, and you are so welcoming and also have a desire to include so many perspectives and understand each and every aspect of our industry. And I really appreciate that. So we're talking about EDRM 1.0, but as you know, if you know, you know, there is an EDRM 2.0 in the works, and Angie and I are part of one of those working groups. So we've had a little taste of that. But why now, you guys? Why did you decide this is the time in 2025 that we want to revise this model and have 2.0?
So to know that answer is to really understand our projects in general, which is Mary and I do not wake up and say, we need this project. They're all organic, and people come to us because of a need or challenge that they want to solve or educate people on. And so 2.0, don't you think, Mary, since we acquired the EDRM, that people have been coming to us saying, that model needs a refresh. It needs an update. It doesn't address all the data. It doesn't address the new tools and the new processes. And so about a year ago, we launched it, and there's over 140 people from all over the globe signed up to help contribute to the project. And it's a timing thing. Enough people, inertia, good leadership, good project trustees, and then the people like you and Angie, the contributors. It's really, really been a joy for Mary and I, because there's a lot of people on our calls, and people are very respectful. They have differing opinions based on where they're sitting or what their experience is, but people respectfully listen. And I think on some really hard issues, we've been able to meet in the middle, and that's going to help and be very powerful for everyone. Don't you think, Mary?
I absolutely do. And then the other thing that's happened, and I mean, you can't have a blog post, a webinar, or a podcast without saying the words AI. but we're in a fundamental restructuring of how legal gets done. And so we felt a responsibility to look at the model. And we said from the beginning, if the model can support going forward in its current state, so much the better. But we wanted to look at it in great detail with the perspective of the community and everybody's experience. And it's pretty clear there'll be some changes. you two were so grateful for your participation in the EDRM 2.0, but you've experienced that there's sequential voting, voting over time, so people can think about it and reasons why you might say yes or no to something that are taken into account by the project leadership of Shannon Bales, Stephanie Clerkin, and Brett Burney there, and Ryan Kennedy, doing mm-hmm. such a lovely, lovely job as stewards and leaders.
I agree. And I think one of my favorite parts about the process has been listening to everybody's differing opinions and the fact that they feel very comfortable to speak their mind, to have an opinion, to explain themselves, and then it to be considered. There's no favorites, nobody talking down to anyone. It's all a very supportive and collaborative environment. I've really enjoyed that.
Sitting in these calls, it's very fun because, to your point, Mary and Kaylee, there will be folks from totally different disciplines or areas of the profession, and they will have diametrically opposed views to how something should go. And then at the end of the day, we come to this really cool sort of consensus that seems to encapsulate all these diverse viewpoints. And so, one of the things I was going to ask you is that, that's been super valuable, but how did you go about ensuring representation from a diverse set of stakeholders?
Our mantra since the day that we acquired the EDRM is all are welcome, but you need to be respectful.
This sounds like what I tell my toddler.
Yeah, like that. We need to listen, right? Everybody gets to have an opinion, and there's no dumb questions. And so when you have a safe environment without sharp elbows and leadership that, like the project trustees, for instance, they understand this is the culture we're curating here for this team, for their particular team. And we've had very few, not even a handful, very few problems. People have just been great. And in terms of the diversity, both globally, people's positions, titles, we didn't recruit for that. People just show up, and we're very thankful.
I think one of the things that we did that's a little bit different is what we're reflecting, what's really happening in the projects that organizations have going to actually produce their data, whether it's to regulators or litigation or M&A or whatever it is. The teams that form, especially in the early days, sometimes the teams would be led by a paralegal. Sometimes they'd be led by somebody who was seconded from IT. Sometimes they'd be led by an attorney. And so we wanted to reflect that very unique part of our practice, in our community is that we tend to work collaboratively to get the job done. So we wanted to make sure that our projects reflected that as well.
Yeah. And so, how do you think the model reflects changes in technology? Because you kind of touched on this a little bit, but how are those, the rise of platforms like Google and Microsoft and Slack and kind of all these iterations of doing work that just didn't exist when the EDRM was first conceived, how are those built into the new model?
Well, I thought that when I first got into e-discovery, so in the year 2000, eons ago, I thought it would take 5 years for the platforms to catch up and to put hooks into their system that would, make e-discovery automatic or automagic. And here we are, 25.
Automagic!
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So here we are 25 years later, they're incrementally doing it, but with the explosion of data types and volumes and things like that, they don't have 100% of it. So the EDRM was never designed to be a linear model where you had to march through each box in sequence. At a certain point in EDRM's evolution, pre-Bulch, Judicial Institute purchasing it, arrows were put into the diagram to show that, you know, there was some iteration going on. And so how it's reflecting the new technology, certainly the addition of the IGRM, the emphasis on what's happening on the left side of the EDRM, which is usually in the organization that is producing, you know, the subject of the requests. And sometimes identification happens in the more towards the IGRM, and it requires a little bit of processing to index that stuff. So there's a little bit of processing happening over in the left, on the left side as well. And so the model has bent to include the new technologies. And now we've got this AI thing, and it is challenging the idea that analysis only happens in one part of the EDRM. Or it looks like it only happens in one part of the EDRM. And so how do we reflect that? And so that's part of your mandate.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Angie and Bree.
It's true. I mean, it almost sounds like the new model reflects the need to address these novel data sources kind of earlier on in the process, even before kind of traditional e-discovery, back at the information governance phase. And then that kind of carries through in this really cool iterative way now, where we're constantly analyzing and assessing, as opposed to like a very strict linear format, which is what the original EDRM sort of conceives.
Yeah, I think in the beginning it was seen in that way, and until those arrows got in. But then also that's an evangelical thing too, because many people do have that opinion. The diagram on a sheet of paper, the one pager, is a linear process. And what we've seen is everybody has their own special sauce. I've seen diagrams where they'll have the EDRM model out and somebody's describing their product, and there'll be boxes that are colored differently. And they're like, this is where we come in. And this box over here is really over here.
Yeah. So do you feel like the EDRM 2.0 makes e-discovery more approachable for newer practitioners? And if so, how?
That's a tough question. There's multiple answers. Yes, it does make e-discovery more approachable. We know, I don't even know, hundreds and hundreds of educators that start with the model. Attorneys, paralegals, new practitioners, new entrants to e-discovery, law school students. And so it's a way to understand from collection all the way through presentation. That makes sense. EDRM 2.0 is the modernization of the original model, which, if you can even believe, is quarter century old. I know Tom Geldman.
I can't, but I still think I'm 21. So
so do I. Tom Geldman, he does too. And he was like 25 years ago. Well, and so I think whether it's the original and then the modernized 2.0, that will sort of address the changes and challenges in today's e-discovery market. I think that it does make it approachable, more approachable and helpful in terms of understanding. And I think it's good for both newcomers and the OGs too.
I would agree. It seems like the model, the EDRM 2.0, and I can't wait for everybody to see it. I feel like we're approaching sort of maybe the last 400 meters of our relay race. And it's really exciting. So I love that. But okay, let's talk more about kind of the evolution and the future of e-discovery, because you've both had a front row seat since, you know, the word go. And so what are the most significant changes in the world of e-discovery that you two have seen over the last decade or so?
For me, I think it's gone from let's negotiate so we don't have to do e-discovery, and all of the permutations of that, the handshake, you know, the wink winks. And it's now part of almost every single legal matter. Sometimes we have like ink on paper for signatures on contracts, but even that is, you know, going digital. As I look at things, I'm most concerned now about authenticity of evidence because in our world of MD5 hashes, so that we can say that, you know, something is the same as it was before, and when we're getting into the quantum era, and that's going to change things. We're seeing the rise of technology that can very easily make videos, audios, text look very, very authentic. So yeah. Those are my concerns.
You know, that's a really interesting question. And I know that authenticity and AI, like those two challenges have sort of gone hand in hand lately. I mean, what do you think the future is going to hold as far as that goes? How are we going to authenticate evidence?
Well, with the rise of deep fakes, it will become a defense mechanism to say, oh, that evidence is a deep fake. Prove it's not. There are a few tools and a few companies that we know that have the capability, the tools, the processes, and the experts to do that. Mary and I have been saying, forensics has their day in the sun, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, big time. The one thing I will tell you was a good friend within the EDRM over Christmas wanted to create a deep fake for his son-in-law. So he asked me, can you help me with that? And I was like, oh, that's going to be a cinch. There's a couple experts who I'll just go and have them tell me how to do it. Well, this was what, 6 months ago, 7 months ago, Mary? Turns out it's not that easy to do, as in really hard. And I wasn't able to do it. Now, that was 7 months with Gen AI, and AI is what, like 3 years? So,
right.
I have no idea, but I think we're going to see the prevalence of it. Like Mary and I said, the forensics need for serious validation.
Mm-hmm. Where do you guys think the burden will lie in the future? I mean, will it be the burden of our lawyers and you know, defendants or parties in lawsuits? Will it be their burden to authenticate evidence, or will it be on software where they're generating the, you know, deep fake videos and audio? Will it be on the burden of the software to prove up authenticity? I know I'm asking you to have a crystal ball, and none of us really know how this is going to work out, but do you have any feels one way or the other?
I think it's going to be a process issue, and I think I think it starts at the information governance phase, where within your organization, you're going to want to know what was created by humans and what was enhanced by an AI or created by an AI, especially, you know, if you're looking at revenue streams like intellectual property and things of that nature. So I think there'll be much like information governance and the platforms around it can tag for confidentiality or, you know, sensitivity or things like that. I think there'll be a reality score, authenticity score, an originality tag. I'm spitballing as to what it'll be, but I think I think that it'll start there. And then once it gets to court, or, well, maybe the step before court, you're never going to want to produce a deep fake. So right. I think there's going to be a quality control, and that might happen at early case assessment, so you're not making things up in your case strategy, or but certainly before production.
I wonder if the federal rules will start prescribing like AI-specific burden shifting, like a burden shifting structure, you know, where you can't just claim deep fake in a la Cry Wolf. You have to produce like some sort of evidence, and then the burden shifts to the party wanting to use that evidence to prove its authenticity. Like, I wonder if you'll see something a little bit more prescriptive like that.
Judge Grimm and Dr. Maura Grossman, among others, have proposed some changes to the federal rules. They're under discussion, and it's uscourts.gov is the site. They have what they call a book, and it is a book because it's close to 1,000 pages of proceedings and whatnot. You can use the Control F function to search through for this, but you know, from a rule standpoint, this is going on, and I think on a case by case, as the judges look at this, it's also going on there too. Yeah.
So we're sitting here talking about AI and what the future looks like in terms of those developments, but What are some developments in the next 5 to 10 years that you think we're not talking about enough that we should be considering?
Yikes. 5 years. 5 years. I'm thinking about the next year, 2 years. Like, what's it going to look like? And
we all right, let's go with that.
We have quantum computing around the corner. And what's that going to mean? I love following Ralph Losey's articles and his education. He's such an AI experimenter. But what I'm wondering is, how in 2 years, what's the pickup really going to look like for AI? Because everybody's talking about it. We all think everyone's using it. But in reality, some are, a lot aren't yet. Individuals are more.
Ralph had a fascinating AI article about morality, like how AIs are dealing with morality. And it is so, his blog is amazing. Everything he writes is incredible.
Yep.
Yeah, Mary, absolutely.
Thoughts?
I'll get on the Ralph bandwagon because I've been a fangirl for a long time. He was a leading light in machine learning and TAR and helping to educate the community around that. And he has taken that to an entirely new level with AI. I'm editing part two of an article now that he has. He poses these questions like you're asking, what's the future going to look like in this particular way? And then he subjects it to his panel of experts. He's built some bots like GPT that he can, you know, send these questions to. And he doesn't just do it for one version. He contrasts version against version. What we would say in IT is like regression testing, almost, to see the models will do and things like that. Ralph has got a vision that it's a very positive force for justice and for access to justice and for better decision making. And it's going to augment us, not replace us. I just absolutely love reading. And then he experiments with the technology. When Kaylee was talking about the deep fakes 7 months ago being difficult to do, with Sora and some of the other tools that have come out, Ralph's got them in his blog, and you can see the evolution of the images and the videos, and the videos now are just amazing. Just
oh my gosh.
Yeah, we were fortunate to have him on the podcast earlier this year, so there's that episode to go back and listen to, but really, there's a wealth of information on his website. I've spent many hours learning, and he's got a whole education program on his site that you might want to check out. That's a great resource, so thank you for bringing that up.
As we start closing out this episode, what advice do you two have for someone who's just starting out in e-discovery today, especially starting out on a landscape that feels like it's sitting atop a tectonic fault?
Ooh, I like that last line.
I don't know if that's scientifically correct. Maybe fault line, two tectonic plates, whatever. Run with it.
I think one of the biggest challenges newcomers to e-discovery and newcomers to legal in general have is that the traditional way that we would bring people up, almost in an apprenticeship model, the training, the ride-alongs, those things used to be structured. Mm-hmm. And I would say that you need to structure your own entry point and your own education. Certainly, we're available at the EDRM. We've got all sorts of resources. And if you're totally brand new and you want to fully immerse and basically teach yourself, Craig Ball, who is a Texas trial attorney, forensics expert, and University School of Law professor, has a workbook with examples that you can work through. So those would be some of the things that I would say would help you. Find like-minded people who will bring you along. Ask somebody to have coffee and pick their brain and offer them something, because you're a newcomer. You probably know about this newfangled thing called AI or social media or something else that you can share with the person whose brain you happen to be picking. Kaylee, what am I leaving out there for the entry points here?
I love the Craig Ball workbook. It's complimentary Free for Everyone, a great, fantastic resource. As you said, find your community. How can you do that? Start following people on LinkedIn. Ask questions. So many people, we have literally the eDiscovery community is the nicest, warmest, and most welcoming community you will find in legal. And I think there's so many people who are willing to put their arm around people and lift them up and help them and point them, if they can't help, point them in a direction to help. The onus is on you to start to do the legwork. And if you're new to eDiscovery, you have a company. Find your friends there. Find the experts. Talk to the experts. They had to learn too. So many of us got thrown into it and learned from the school of hard knocks like me.
That's true.
Yeah.
And you probably will too on some level.
Yeah.
Anyone just starting out.
There's a lot of resources. A lot.
Thank you guys for being here today. I do have one question that I do want to ask you before we close up here. Angie and I talk a lot about why we spend our extra time recording and preparing and finding guests and all the things that go into a podcast. And it's because it means something very near and dear to our hearts for different reasons for both of us. But Mary and Kaylee, when we think about the eDiscovery industry and your career and the EDRM and all the people and places that have come in between your years of experience, what does that mean to you personally? Why do you keep coming to work every day and carrying the torch of eDiscovery and promoting people and encouraging people? Why does that mean something to you?
So, as Mary likes to say, it's our heart work. We're not raking in the big bucks. Let me just be clear. Our thing is to make a difference, to help make a difference in each person's life, in the ability to have resources, grow a career, find a job. For example, we acquired the EDRM in 2019 at the end of October. And as you all may well remember, beginning of March of 2020, world shut down. And at that point, Mary literally called me and said, we have to have a community call. The community is going to need a place to gather, talk about what's happening, get support, give support. That was 286 weeks ago, over 5 years. And every Tuesday, people still show up. We show up, whether it's a holiday or not. Heart work, the EDRM and all the different things that we do. We love our trusted partners. We love the community. It gives me personally endless energy and joy. Mary?
Yeah, I echo all of the thoughts that Kaylee has just expressed around the people and making a difference in people's lives. And also, I think for me, it's, and many of us, the legal system is at what the venture capital people and the private equity people would call an inflection point. It's changing so rapidly. And it used to be that lawyers and legal people built the structures of society. And now it's the platforms, it's the tech platforms that are doing that. And that whether or not they have ethics, morals, as you were talking about with some of Ralph's blogs, or they're even thinking about future impacts, what do they call externalities in legal, we're the multidisciplinary community that has the capability to communicate with each other and to help shape what these platforms are going to be, because that's what our children and our grandchildren will be growing up. It's law is code, that kind of thing. And so that keeps me going and making sure that the humans that are involved in this have a support system to talk with each other. As we navigate these changes, because it will mean changes in employment and job duties and status and all sorts of things for many, many people. And we are humans and we need support to deal with all of that.
Ain't that the truth? Well, Mary, Kaylee, thank you so much for being with us today. It was such a joy to have you both on the pod. And we are so lucky that you, you know, were here with us today and have shared all of your wisdom with our listeners. So just Absolutely. A big, big thank you.
Thank you so much.
We're honored to be part of it.
Big time. Thank you. And thank you for your great podcast. We're huge fans.
Yay. Oh, gosh. Well, that just means the world to us.
It does.
All right, folks, I think that's all the time we have today. So thank you so much for joining us on eDiscovery Chicks. We hope you learned something new, felt empowered, or just had some fun along the way. Don't forget to join the flock by following us on LinkedIn and Instagram, and check out our website, eDiscoveryChicks.com. If you loved this episode, share it with your network, leave us a review, or tag us on our socials with your favorite takeaway. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. Catch us next time. Until then, flock on, friends.
Bye.
Bye.
The views we've expressed today are the eDiscovery Chicks views and don't necessarily represent the views of our employers, partners, or clients. The podcast is available solely for educational purposes to provide general information about eDiscovery principles and not to provide legal advice to any specific situation. It is not a substitute for legal advice from a lawyer you retained or who has agreed to represent you.